Listen, you're a business leader. People watch what you do all the time. You can't get away from it. If you don't want people to watch you in detail, don't become a business leader. That's the deal. Okay? So the question isn't, are they going to watch you carefully? And are you like, the question is, are you going to do things that when they watch you have the effect of changing stories in the organization and thus the culture?
Welcome to the Leading Transformational Change Podcast. Our passion is to help you lead and develop organizations with a remarkably healthy culture that can positively impact all of its stakeholders. Every other Thursday, we drop hour-long conversations with world-leading researchers and experts on culture, ethics, change, and leadership. My name is Tobias Sturson, and I'm your host and the co-founder of Art Management. What do you believe is the most essential key to a successful culture change initiative? Is it defining a new set of values, assessing the current culture, or is it putting together a robust culture change team? According to research by Jay Barney, co-author of the new book, The Secrets of Culture Change, How to Build Authentic Stories That Transform Your Organization, the answer is senior leaders taking bold action before ever announcing the culture change initiative. This does ring true to my experience. I found that many organizations enter into culture change initiatives without having committed to doing what it takes to truly change the culture. Beginning by taking bold action turns this on its head. It forces leaders to commit to the change process, and it becomes an authentic story that can spread throughout the organization. But yet, it requires leaders willing to take ownership and stop pointing fingers at everyone else. Because without the readiness to see, accept, and acknowledge our role as leaders, our efforts to influence our culture will become manipulative, inauthentic, and ultimately fail. And I'm sure some of you have experienced those kind of initiatives before. On the other hand, when we take ownership and take action, we can build trust and commitment. Jay Barney is professor of strategic management at the David Eccles School of Business. I read his fascinating article on creating stories that change your company's culture in the September-October issue of the Harvard Business Review, and I immediately wanted to have him on the podcast, and I was so happy when he replied and had a chance to get on really, really quickly. In our conversation, Jay gives practical examples from some of the many companies they have studied as a part of their extensive research into culture change and how culture becomes a competitive advantage. I've found Jay's work so helpful that I've asked him to come back on the podcast again, and we're going to have that conversation a bit later. But I truly hope that you will enjoy our conversation as much as I did and that you will find it practical, helpful, and that it will help you build a healthier culture in your organization. However, before we start the conversation, I wanted to tell you about a free PDF guide that we've developed to help you lead lasting culture change. In our work with numerous organizations, we've realized that how organizations typically approach culture change and values integration just doesn't work. That's why we put together a free resource with 6 vital steps to leading lasting culture change and making values matter. And we've already received so much great feedback on the people who have downloaded it since we launched it just a few weeks ago. So go and download your free guide today at heartmanagement.org/guide. You get your guide at heartmanagement.org/guide. But now, without further ado, let's jump into my conversation with Professor Jay Barney. Jay, it's really a privilege to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you. I look forward to it.
And in our conversation before, I just have to mention this for our Swedish listeners who are in a minority, but since I'm based in Sweden, it still needs to be mentioned. So you're actually, as well as all the other things, you have an honorary doctorate at Lund University, which is very close to where I'm based. So that's exciting.
That's correct. I've always enjoyed my time.
I'm so glad to hear that. So you're a professor of strategic management, and what made you become interested in organizational culture?
Well, two things. First of all, in 1996, which is a long time ago, I wrote a paper that was titled, Can Organizational Culture Be a Source of Sustained Competitive Advantage? And it was simply, the answer to that question is yes. So I used a particular economic logic to make that point. But from a more practical point of view, I have, even though I'm primarily a theorist, and I have actually had a reasonably robust consulting career. And when I would go into a company and do a strategic analysis, I often run into the problem that the strategy we need to pursue is inconsistent with the organization's culture. And this is not uncommon. In fact, I would say over 80% of the consulting activities I engaged in, there was at least a tension between strategic change and the culture was in place in the organization. And for many years, I didn't have any particularly rigorous or effective approach to how to change an organization's culture. And so when the opportunity came to really investigate that idea, I took it. And the result is the research in the book that we're going to talk about.
That is so helpful. And so many times when we talk about organizational culture, and on this podcast, we talk about healthy culture as thinking about something that enables mission success, where we can successfully deliver on our mission and strategy. It enables a thriving workplace, and it enables responsible impact. And I think that so many times we're solely focused on the thriving workplace, and we don't think enough about the importance of our culture and our strategy to be aligned. And you and I talked about the quote, culture eats strategy for breakfast, which is many people have attributed to Peter Drucker. We now know he never said that. At least that's what you told me that his colleagues say. So, but could you say something more about how you look at strategy and culture and the relationship between strategy and culture? And also, because I think a lot of our listeners, they're trying to make the case internally and say, okay, this is why culture matters. This is why we need to put focus here. And for me, it's like, it's this question that is almost absurd in a sense, because it's like, if we think that culture is something that influences every way of how we do our work, how we collaborate, how we make decisions, and so on, it's saying what's kind of the ROI of air. But what would you say to that?
Let me comment first on the culture eats strategy for breakfast. I think it's just it's a phrase we can sort of all identify with that sort of says, listen, the bottom line is, yeah, you can do all the strategic analysis you want, but unless you have a culture that's aligned with that strategy, it's not going to happen. The culture that exists, if it's inconsistent with the strategy you're trying to implement, culture is going to win that competition between strategy and those values. The organization, the values will dominate, and you won't be able to implement your culture. Certainly, that's been my experience. I don't say this often, but when I work with companies, strategic decisions are actually usually not that complicated. You need to go from an organization that is trying to accomplish a set of government mandates to one that is now competing for customers in a marketplace. Those are very different strategies, and they obviously require very different cultures. So coming to the strategy decisions, it's not easy, but the hardest part is implementation of the strategy. And the hardest part of implementation is, of course, changing an organization's culture. That's why culture eats strategy for breakfast, so to speak, because it's so important. One thing that's important, we began our research with no desire to try to describe an ideal culture. In fact, if our primary emphasis is on aligning culture and strategy, since strategies vary across companies, it would be surprising if there was any one set of cultural values that was the best in all circumstances. Extremely unlikely, actually. So we're not trying to describe that here are the 8, or is it 10, or maybe it's 12. It's usually 12. Here are the 12 attributes of a culture that make it successful in all settings. Our view is Culture is relevant to the extent that it enables a firm to more successfully implement its strategy. And so that's the thing we've really been focusing on.
That's really helpful. And I think for our listeners, we really need to understand this, because I think so many times we sit with our strategy and then we make kind of reorganizations and we move boxes on papers, but we don't look at how we think as a group, how we act as a group, how we identify as a group, how does that actually impact whether we will be successful doing this? And then again, we just think that then culture, it's just about whether employees like working at the company or not. And I think that's also part of where I think our HR people listening and our HR leaders listening need to kind of push back and say, no, that's not it. And so we can't, unless HR is the one who kind of owns every aspect of the strategy in the company, HR cannot own every aspect of the culture in the company. And you write in your recent Harvard Business Review article, and of course, we will talk more about the book that article is based upon, but I was so excited to find it because you write about the importance of creating stories that change culture.
Right.
And when we talk in our work about essential leadership habits for a healthy culture, we talk about telling better stories as a critical practice. But I've never found anyone who's written on the topic with the depth that you have. So hats off to you for that. And you begin your article by stating that in your study, none of the successful initiatives, which was culture change initiatives, had begun with a list of desired core values for new culture. None had begun with detailed studies of the current culture, its relationship to strategy implementation, and none had begun by revising HR policies, including those for employee evaluation and compensation. And then you then go on to say that those became important along the way. So it's not that they don't matter, but instead you mean that they began with stories. So now help us understand what you mean with that.
Okay, so by building stories, what we mean is that business leaders engage in activities that exemplify a new culture that are clearly different than old culture, but they don't actually announce that they're going to change the culture. One of my favorite stories is in the book is of a guy named Fernando Aguirre, who's was a division general manager for Procter & Gamble in South America. He shows up in the company in the organization. P&G had acquired the company a few months or years earlier, hadn't done a lot of due diligence apparently, because as he went to the numbers, they were losing money. Every time they sold a dollar of a product, they lost 40 cents. You can't make that up on volume, okay? That's not a good game. So he had to change the strategy of the organization. But to do that, he also had to change the culture, because no one knew that they were in financial difficulty. And no one knew that they had to change their whole mindset. So he did a whole bunch of things. He will tell you, we're all designed to try to improve the financial performance organization. He went out to the factories where people were working, and he had factory-wide meetings, and he had conversations with employees asking for their ideas and their support. He had the prior CEO, had built a very large, expensive office building that they couldn't afford. He closed it. It had been decorated with all this artwork. He put it all in boxes and either sold it or stored it. He says, we're not a company that can afford that building or that art, on and on. And he saw all of these in simple cost terms. Got to get our costs in line, got to get our revenue in a better position. But I was just talking to him recently about that. He said, I wasn't thinking about it, but I was in fact changing my organization's culture. I was valuing these employees and their perspectives. I told them we were in difficulty. We didn't make a change. Half the people in this room are going to have to lose their job. We must change how we're doing things, but by engaging them. By the way, he was in Brazil. All of his employees spoke Portuguese. He spoke Spanish and English. He's from Mexico originally. And first thing he did is he tried to learn Portuguese. And his Portuguese was terrible. Think about what signal he's sending. I am your CEO. I barely speak your language. And I'm going to come in front of you, and I'm going to engage you in changing this organization. That symbol of how important it was, how humble he was, and he had his HR manager next to him correcting his Portuguese because it was so bad. I mean, all of those things had this huge impact on that organizational culture. Now, he originally proposed a three-year plan. I think it was a three-year plan to turn the business around. The CEO at Procter & Gamble said, no, you have 1 year. You have 1 year to turn this thing around. And he did. He actually turned it around. They went from $70 million in revenue, rounding error, to $7 billion in revenue 10 years later. So a very, very successful turnaround effort. But it was all driven by actions that he took that had the effect of building stories that then replaced the old stories the complacency and the lack of initiative, lack of innovation that was the old stories. You replace those with new stories that were very compelling for people, and the results are speak for themselves.
So this is super fascinating, I think. And I think it's important to note, because I think when people came into this, and we probably have some communications professionals listening in as well, and I have that background as well. So I think we've been waiting to hear, okay, so this, they were crafting some kind of smart PR statements or whatever, but that's not what you're talking about. You're actually talking about taking action, which itself became a new type of story that started to spread through the organization. Is that correct?
That is correct. In fact, the whole trick is to not craft language or a narrative or a story. Let your actions speak and then have other people craft it. And as they do so, they try to understand. This is counterintuitive to some people, but we saw it as a positive when CEOs or business leaders were engaging in these radical changing, culture changing activities. Their direct reports were often confused. What are you doing? This is not the way we do things around here. Of course, that was the point. That's exactly the point. And so engaging in activities that break with the past, with a path to the future, what that does is it forces people to start trying to make sense of what you're doing. And then they become part of the culture change process as they engage in that activity. And as they share the story that they've observed and retell it as it evolves over time. So Mark Twain we was talking about quotes earlier. This one is actually real. Mark Twain has said that actions speak louder than words, but not nearly so often. Words are, it's cheap talk. We need a new culture, cheap talk. Join me in culture change, cheap talk. Because as soon as headwinds start to blow, and they will, because culture change is hard, financial realities get in the way often. As soon as headwinds start to blow, that cheap talk goes away and all hands on deck on the finances. But actions are harder to walk back because people see what you did. And as you do that more and more, it becomes less, more and more difficult to back off of the commitment you've made to culture change. Not through words, but through your actions.
So interesting. And you write that crafting new stories forces business leaders to commit to culture change in a way that creating new HR policies or cultural charters doesn't.
That's right. Let me give you an example of that. This is a relatively young entrepreneur, another story in the book, relatively young entrepreneur, bright, very aggressive, but he's read someplace that he needs to have an organizational in his firm, entrepreneurial firm. And so he goes off to his office and generates this long list of values that he thinks are important in his culture. And then he puts the value list up on the wall to let people know what's going on. And then a week or so later, he finally goes to someone, a trusted colleague, and says, "So what do people think of the values?" He says, "They're mocking them." "So what do you mean they're mocking them? This is who I am. These are my values. They're critical." "Yeah, they're making fun of them." He says, "Well, like, what do you mean?" He says, "Well, your eighth value is to have fun. No one here wants to have fun at work. What we're trying to do is create generational wealth. We want to create a company that when we sell it, we can not have to work again. We can be with our families in the way we want to, and our kids and our grandkids. It's not about having fun. I have fun outside of work. My friends are outside of work. I am here not to have fun. We are here to generate generational wealth, okay? Take off fun off the list. This was not supposed to be a fun place to work. This is supposed to be a place to generate wealth." And so those kinds of top-down announcements, we're going to build a new culture, like I said in the article and in the book. I'm not going to say they don't exist, but they don't exist in our data. We have no examples of where it starts with an announcement of a culture change or a study of a current culture. It's just the opposite on the study. Let me tell a story. So I was in the 1980s, I was doing a lot of work with Hewlett-Packard Corporation. At the time, had a remarkable culture, remarkably empowering, phenomenal. Learned a lot from them. And I developed some expertise in how their culture worked. I was then contacted by one of their competitors who wasn't doing so well. And everyone in the Valley, Silicon Valley, knew why they weren't doing so well. And that's because they had a very risk-averse culture. At HP at the time, if you do something that was well-reasoned but didn't work, that was an opportunity to learn. And as another company, it was an opportunity to fire somebody. And so I got this phone call from an HR manager at that second company. I'm not going to name it. You'll see why in a second. And they said, "Hello, Professor Barney. We understand you do a lot of work with Hewlett-Packard." I said, "Yeah." "And you understand their culture very well?" "Yeah." "Well, we just completed a six-month study that revealed that we have a risk-averse culture. 6 months? Are you kidding me? 5 minute conversation with anyone in the valley would have told you that, but it took him 6 months to do this. So I already knew it was going to be a hard process. Someone didn't want to hear that message. So 6 months. And what we want you to do, Professor Barney, is we'd like you to come here, help us get rid of our old culture, and then build a new culture. And we'd like to do this all within 6 weeks. I said, this is stillborn. There is no hope for this culture change, okay? And I said, it might make sense, just an idea, for senior management organization to start behaving in ways that encourage risk-taking. There was silence on the other end of the phone, and that was a very short consulting relationship. So anyway, that's why when I see organizations spending time and money and energy documenting their own culture, and they may do that for other reasons. I don't want to make it so bad, but culture change is not one of those reasons.
To push back a little bit, we've had, for example, Kevin Oakes here on the podcast, and they've done a lot of research through I4CP, where they've looked at successful culture initiatives, and they see that one of the key to success is getting an understanding of what to keep and what to change. And I'm like, when I hear your story of that leader, I still sense that he did that. Like he actually, and I'm thinking about, for example, another leader who I've had the privilege of interviewing a few times, Frank Blake, who came in at the Home Depot and led really a transformation there. Right. And we have a conversation with him on this podcast after. Right. And really, where I would say really he did what you're saying. He really started creating new stories around excellent customer service and showing that was valued within the company right, again. Right. But it started somehow with listening. I mean, it started somehow with getting an understanding of, okay, so why aren't we successful today? Why aren't our people feeling like customer service matters? So I just still feel that they've actually did that. But as you say, they did not spend 6 months doing it, but they did it kind of rapidly. And then they took action. Yeah.
There's an important distinction here is, first of all, there's no doubt that certainly when you're a new CEO, for example, or a new business leader, or sometimes you have the luxury to take some time to sort of think carefully about what's going on. What strategy do we need to change, if any, and what cultural implications does that have? So that can be true. I'm not denying any of that. That tends to focus mostly on what strategy do we have? How does that new strategy map onto our current culture? The studies that I've seen on culture, the ones that don't seem to be associated with culture change, are primarily descriptive, not evaluative. They're independent of strategy. I mean, again, culture is valuable to the extent that it enables a firm to to implement its strategies. It's economically valuable. It has other values as well, but it's economically valuable to the extent that it enables strategic change. So another story that I'll refer to, this is sort of the seminal story. This is with told to me by my co-author, Manuel Amara, who is a CEO of a Brazilian telecom, Telesp. When he took over that company as a CEO, he was coming again from Procter & Gamble, another P&G example. And he had been in charge of the Pampers business in all of South America. So he goes into this telecommunications company, and his nickname is the diaper guy. Okay, there was an internal betting pool about how long the diaper guy would last in this telecommunications company. But what happened was that organization, we can talk about this in more detail if you want to, but that organization had existed in a highly regulated monopoly situation, and we had government mandates that they were fulfilling, and had created appropriately a very top-down culture. Now, they had gone to the extreme, total command and control, so much, for example, that the CEO, no one could ride in the same elevator car as a CEO. That's how hierarchical top-down it had become. Bizarre to me. But that monopoly was about to go away. They were going to have new competitors. They were going to have changes in technology, in telecommunications technology, mobile and internet, and those kinds of things. And it's not going to be top-down from the government anymore. It was going to be competing against other really good companies. And it was clear that you needed to have a change in strategy that focused on customer orientation and satisfaction and technological innovation, and that the top-down model wasn't going to work. Now, speaking of the question of listening and developing, Manuel didn't have any legitimacy coming in as the CEO of that business unit. So, but he suspected this was going on. That was his hypothesis. So he did get some legitimacy. He hires McKinsey, the consulting firm, comes in, does a strategic analysis and says, yep, you're going from this world to this world, this new world that requires a whole different set of skills. And so you need to change the strategy. That gives him cover then. Says, yeah, it's not just me thinking this, it's other people thinking this. That gives him cover then to begin the culture change process. But note here, he didn't stand up. He presented that strategic change to everyone, but he didn't stand up and then announce that therefore they're going to do culture change. he started behaving as if, in a way, it would be consistent with a new culture. That story focuses on how he had trouble with the technology, but called the call center. As a CEO, he calls the call center, works with this young kid in the call center for about an hour and a half, 2 hours, can never fix the problem, tells the kid, hey, I'm the CEO of the company. The young man doesn't believe him. Why would he? The CEO's been on the phone for almost two hours trying to fix this problem. And then Manuel asks this young man to come, remember this, deeply hierarchical culture, to come to the next executive committee meeting and to give a lecture to the senior vice presidents of the company about what 14 things he needed to know about this new product in order to provide service. And this young man does that. And then it turns out they didn't know much. They knew seven of the 14 things. Manuel assigns the executives to come up with a new plan to solve that problem. And then to present that plan to solve this problem at the next executive committee meeting to the hourly workers in the call center. This just turns the culture upside down. Now, it's all consistent with a strategy, customer orientation, innovation, those kinds of things. But to do that, you have to turn the culture from this top down to literally a bottom up culture. And he begins that process through that story building. But it helped to have McKinsey say it's a good strategy.
Yeah. And it is a powerful story. And I love that. And I'm thinking about the quote that I don't remember it exactly, but that it's probably easier to think your or to act yourself into a new way of thinking than to think yourself into a new way of acting. And basically
of acting. Yeah, that's right.
And so one of the things that I see in working with organizations and leaders when it comes to culture. So when we work with organizations and let's say, okay, they've identified, okay, this is generally the change that we need to be making within our culture, I often find that leaders are very hesitant to take ownership and take action, and that it's easy to come to a place where I've sat down, and this is something that happened quite recently. This was with an organization where just like when it came to the point of actually doing something, we just landed on this place of inertia. And I think also that a way that culture and values generally have been approached is kind of, okay, so the organization identifies a new set of values, and then the leadership team, they don't actually need to change anything, but it skips out to the team members, and now HR or the managers are going to have workshops with the team members to talk about with them about changing their behaviors, and perhaps sometimes you'll invite an inspirational speaker.
Blah, blah. That's right.
Yes.
And we're surprised it doesn't work.
Yes, very surprising. But I mean, I sat down with the CEO and I said, okay, like before you do anything else, I want you to decide on where you're going to take action and start changing what you own in this process and what you can change. And then when you've started working on your behavior, then you can give that invitation to the rest of the senior management and tell, okay, now you do the same. And then we can continue to the organization, but it has to start there. And one thing I wanted to ask you, because we're going to jump into the different aspects of story that you bring up in your book, and I really want to get to that.
Sorry.
But like, just one of those first things there is like, how do you decide on what action to take?
How does the leader decide on what action to take?
Yeah, exactly. How do you decide, like, okay, this is a kind of good first step?
So a couple of ways I'd like to talk about that. The first of it is I can't build a story for a leader because that violates principle number one, which is that it has to be authentic. The leader has to build their own story. And the way they do it is they look for or create opportunities to contradict. So everything, the story I told about Telespeed, the story I told about P&G in South America, those two CEOs, they saw the strategy had to change, the culture had to change. They came to that conclusion on their own. And then they started engaging in activities, behaviors. They did stuff that changed the culture. The thing about it is sometimes this is more anarchy than some business leaders like, certainly some CEOs who believe that in the mythology that they actually control their organization. And because of the following, the leaders begins the culture change process by engaging in activities that build stories. But that doesn't mean that that business leader has in his or her mind the set of values that are going to be the six or seven defining values of the culture sometime in the future. It's more directional. And so if you stand up too early and say these are the six values you're going to have, that's cheap talk, so nothing matters. What matters is seeing your behavior, and then people making sense of it begin to derive the values in the organization. And that does two things. First, it makes it so you as the business leader don't have to know all the I's, how to dot all the I's and cross all the T's on culture change when you start. Because no one can do that. No one's that smart. It evolves in ways that are very difficult to predict. So you can start culture change just by saying, I don't know for sure where we're going to go, but I know we're going somewhere and it's going to be cool. It's going to be more aligned with our strategy than our current situation. The second thing is it engages your employees in co-creating the culture with you. This is not a list of six values that are shared in a room. Everyone says, okay, six values. All right, I sign up for that. And everyone's going to nod their head knowing that this too shall pass. And so they're going to ignore it in the long run. But if, on the other hand, they co-create, if they make sense of your activities and helps the stories that you build and helps them understand those values, and then something else even more fundamental, they begin building their own stories that are consistent with the values that you understand. Now, later on, as you go through that process, sure, you can then articulate what those key values are. But that's the end of the process. That's not the beginning of the culture change process. Culture change begins when business leaders behave in ways that create stories, that build stories, that replace old stories that employees share with new stories that employees share. And then it's co-created over time between employees and those business leaders.
Wow, that's super, super insightful. It starts there. And you talk about the importance of these stories being authentic. Is there something more that you want to say to that? And I also think when we talk a lot about in our work around like the importance of getting humble and taking ownership for our responsibility in the culture, understanding that we're vulnerable and so on. I see that a lot in your thinking around this as well. Could you, just something shortly around how you think about the importance of authentic stories.
Authenticity is essential, as we say in the book. Your employee can smell hypocrisy a mile away. We want a transparent culture, but you're not transparent. We want a risk-taking culture, but you're not risk-taking. We want innovation, but you're controlling. It's not going to work, and people are going to discount you. Interestingly enough, the authenticity requirement is actually a very demanding requirement for business leaders, because it may be that they're not the right person for the job to lead a culture change. Because if the culture, say, requires a risk, more risk-taking, and they are risk-averse, can't fake it. People know that. And so you may have to recuse yourself from the culture change, promote yourself to become board chair, or retire early. If culture change is that important, you may not be the right person. Authenticity has another impact as well, because you're going to be, business leaders are going to try to enroll others to build their own stories. It's very likely that there will be people in an organization who have been loyal and successful in that organization over many years and successful in the old culture. In fact, they may have joined the company because of the old culture, and you're in the process of changing that culture. And those people will feel betrayed, bait and switch, and that it's unfair. And you know what? They're exactly right. It is unfair. But the strategy has to change. Therefore, the culture has to change. You either get on board or you don't get on board. Part of authenticity is actually coming to grips with having to fire people, many of whom have been loyal friends for many years, have to fire people whose behaviors are inconsistent with the new culture you're trying to create. So a friend of mine was hired to help lead a change, a culture change in a large retail organization. I won't mention the names. Most of the names are revealed in the book. When we don't have permission, we keep them secret, obviously, private. And I asked him, I said, what would you have done differently in that change process? And he said, the first day I was on the job, I have 10 direct reports. I could see five of them were going to resist this culture change no matter what they did. They were going to fight this thing tooth and nail. I should have fired those people the first day. I didn't. A year later, I fired all five, the same five, and it cost us millions of dollars in a full year in the culture change process. So you either change who the people are or you change the people. And so business leaders, those are hard decisions to make, but those are decisions they often make in our experience.
And in a European setting, and they are even harder because you don't, yes, I mean, we have different labor laws and so on. So that's
correct.
Yeah. So, and secondly, you write about the need to star in your own story. And I'm thinking about the power of when a leader is kind of openly talking about their own change, how they have to change as a part of the change process and the story that's great. Could you say something about that?
So it's interesting. We've gotten some pushback on this because some people say, starting your own story, isn't that self-aggrandizement? Isn't it sort of an ego thing? And our response is, listen, you're a business leader. People watch what you do all the time. You can't get away from it. If you don't want people to watch you in detail, don't become a business leader. That's the deal, okay? So the question isn't, are they going to watch you carefully? And the question is, are you going to do things that when they watch you have the effect of changing stories in the organization and thus the culture? It is what it is. I mean, as a business leader, if you don't star in the story, if you delegate the story building process to a consulting firm or to a summer intern, it doesn't have the impact. I may give you another example, another story from the book. This is a guy who heads up Gillette's international business in developing economies. And it turns out at the time he took over, Gillette was doing very poorly in India, primarily in India. I mean, they sold, I think the number is like 2,000 razors. I mean, nothing in India. And they didn't know why. And the cultural reason why is at the time, products for India and the developing economies were developed in Gillette's laboratories and then tested on Indian men in England and in Boston area. And they thought the razors were great. And then they sent them on to India and then nothing happened, right? He said, he looked at all that situation. He said, I'm going to India. This was a radical idea. I'm going to India because you don't do that. The labs create the product. You don't go talk to consumers. So he and a group of his employees go to India. And what they discover is that their model in their mind of how people shave in India is completely different than reality. So in reality, impoverished people don't shave in their bathroom. They have usually share a bathroom with several other families. So they shave in a room in their house. And so they don't have running water necessarily to clean their razor. They have a little glass of water. They shake it back and forth. And they don't have a place to store their razor. They just have a nail. They hang their razor up on the nail. Gillette's razor didn't have a hole in the handle. You can't sell a razor that doesn't have a hole in the handle. And Gillette's razors got clogged up because in the United States and England, where they had tested these razors, there was good water pressure that would clean the razor out. But if you just shake it in a glass, it gets clogged up. So on the way home, they designed a new razor. And long story short, within 2 years, they have 20% of the market in India for razors. Now, what's interesting is that division general manager, that business leader, he went to India. What if he had assigned a marketing analyst or a summer intern or had hired a marketing company to go to India, find out the same information, then come back, present a report? There's no culture change there because now it's just another report. But because they all went to India, because they had that experience together, and it forced them to confront everything they had thought about selling razors in India, it was very powerful. So you have to start your own story. There's no, hey, you don't have a choice. Let's put it this way. If he had outsourced the trip to India to someone else, he would have started the story, but it would not have been a culture-changing story. It would have been a story that reinforced the idea that the way to build products for the Indian market is through the labs rather than talking to customers.
Yeah, very great examples. And your third thing here is you write about stories that break with the past and create the path to the future. And I think we've talked a lot about that and that aspect of, really, it's like asking, so how can we act in line? I would use the word bold actions that we could take that are in line with the future that we see, with kind of the strategy that we set, with the culture that we need. Is that the right mindset here?
Exactly right. In fact, a colleague of mine who had read the book and was giving me some ideas said the words he said was, it's public courage. And you say, these are CEOs, business leaders, division general managers, functional managers, plant managers. Why is this public courage for their part? In fact, these people are doing heroic things. They are engaging in activities that are deeply inconsistent with the received view about how the organization should operate. So it absolutely requires enormous courage and boldness because you're violating norms and expectations. Like I said earlier, a really good indicator that you're doing a good job is when your direct reports are confused. They should be confused. because they represent the old culture typically, and those direct reports, you're doing stuff that is inconsistent. So they start by saying, he's doing strange things, and this is odd. Maybe he's mad. Maybe he's just crazy. We've heard all those kinds of responses initial story building efforts. Over time, a pattern emerges. This path to the future, though, is a really important concept. In fact, you don't know, this contradicts a truth, right? It's important that you don't know the end from the beginning, okay? At least in detail. You sort of know the direction you want to go. But if you can try to do too much upfront planning, then you control the emergent process by which culture is co-created. And then that disempowers your employees. And then they're going to be very skeptical about your culture change. So it's a path to the future, not a well-described step-by-step path, a set of steps you have to take to create a culture change.
One of the most powerful experiences that I've had in my work was working with an organization that had gone through a scandal. So they were really in a place where trust had been breached and, yeah, really in a very tough spot. And it was unclear if they would be able to move forward. The scandal had been highly publicized and so on. And one of the things that we did there, and this is really, they took the time to really reflect on what was it in our culture that kind of led us down the wrong path. And then they, because one thing that had been a thing in their culture was that the leader, the president of this was an NGO, never, and that the founder basically never apologized for anything. So it was not a culture where you would say, okay, we did something wrong. So what they did was, I mean, we spent actually a lot of time really reflecting on this and what had gone wrong and so on. And then they came in front of their organization and the whole leadership team read and shared their stories and share what they've seen in the culture, what they've learned. And then they apologized and to the whole organization for the impact it had, for the distance they had created between leaders. And it's one of the most powerful things that I've ever seen. And it created such a shift in the organization. And I'm now, as we're talking, I'm just thinking about it because that created a new story in line. And so I think one important thing here is there's something that leaders should think about specifically in terms of making the story spread and stick.
Okay, let me respond to first year real quick. That was really moving. I would guess, by the way, that the reason that the apologies were culture changing was because of the work that went on before the apologies were.
Yeah, totally, yes.
So we have a story in the book. One thing that people worry about is, business leaders worry about is that I'm going to be trying to implement these new values and I don't always live up to them. Well, that's because you're a human being, okay? But your failure to live up to them actually becomes an opportunity to build a story. So we have one example of where this guy is trying to build a culture. It's a consulting firm trying to build a culture of collaboration and respect. It's late one night. He's trying to get home really fast. He's tired. One of his subordinates comes up, gives him a report. He looks at it quickly and it says, this is just bullshit. Throws this away. And completely inconsistent with the values that this guy is trying to put into place. The subordinate calls him on the phone later that night and says, I didn't like how you treated me. I thought that was wrong. And this guy says, you're right. I blew it. I'm glad you called me on it. And here's what I want you to do. I want you to continue to call me on it. And I want you to tell everyone in the organization what I did and how you called me on it and how I responded. We're going to build a story here about how we can get better at implementing those kinds of things. So I don't worry about trying to be perfect. Worry about being transparent and authentic, but not necessarily perfect.
And I just want to say what you said there is so incredibly important. And just everyone listening, just take that to heart. And there's so many organizations that promise on their website, these are our values, they permeate all behavior, and they guide all decisions at this company. It's bullshit. I mean, that's not true anywhere. And as you say, being honest about how we're failing is, to me, it's one of the most powerful stories we can create as parents to our kids or as leaders in our organizations.
Yeah, absolutely. It sort of humanizes the culture change process. We're all in this together. So if you start with a list of six values that you're then driving the organization towards, that's completely different than if you're co-creating those with your employees in a way that engages them in the process in the context of driving towards strategy implementation. So it's all there. It's much more real, much more powerful. We won't get to this, but culture change is about head and heart. It's got to be a business model. It's got to be a business reason for doing it. It was just because I've always wanted to have a culture that has my values. It's just an ego trip. But if there's a business reason for doing it, then that's great. But it also has to appeal, because it's culture. It has to appeal to our values, our sense of identity and purpose, to the better angels of our nature, to quote Lincoln. And so that's another dimension of this change process.
So, Jay, and I just want to be conscious of your time here. And we've never done this on the podcast before, but I'm actually asking here, would you be open to kind of do a part two at some point of this conversation? Because I just felt like it would be amazing to kind of take the next step. And I think a lot of our leaders, our listeners, I should say, are hungry for that as well. So based on what we've been talking about now.
Sure, absolutely. I as I mentioned to you, I think the questions you sent were really interesting, and I like to talk about them. They're a lot of fun for me. So yeah, absolutely.
We'll schedule that. But before we leave this conversation, I just wanted to ask you, and of course, really recommend, read and buy first Jay's book, The Secret of Culture Change. It's a great book. I've been reading it. I've just found out about you and the book just a few days ago. So I've been going through it fast, but fantastic work. And as you say, so many stories, which I think is incredibly helpful. And if you want to get an overview over it, there's an article in the latest Harvard Business Review magazine, which kind of gives a teaser, I would say, to the book. But what are ways that people can connect with you and learn more about your work?
Well, we have a Secret of Culture Change website that has a bunch of podcasts that I've written. It's kind of fun. I've never done this before. I'm a scholar. That's what I do for a living. So this is really fun for me. I like one of the five ways that you will doom your culture change efforts. And when will you have to change culture? All those kinds of things. So yeah, I think it's secretofculturechange.org or something. So pretty straightforward. So that would be the easiest way. Also, I have a personal website, but that's referred off the Secret of Culture Change website as well.
Beautiful. Jay, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge, sharing your insights, and taking time for this conversation and really contributing, as we say, as the vision of our company, Hearts Management, and this podcast, to see a world where organizations with a healthy culture become the norm and not the exception. So thank you for your important work in that field.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, it really means the world to us if you would share, rate, and review it on iTunes. We're super grateful for all the 5-star reviews and generous comments that we've received so far. It really helps us take the message of purpose and integrity to a wider audience. And finally, don't forget to grab your free PDF on leadingtransformationalchange.com. See you in 2 weeks.